This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Hard hits, cheap shots, huge stakes. Well, enough about the primaries. Time now for sports. Tomorrow, Conference Championship Sunday. Almost as big as the Super Bowl, just without all those distracting halftime wardrobe malfunctions. NPR's Tom Goldman joins us. Morning, Tom.
Hello, Scott.
And AFC plays first tomorrow. The Baltimore Ravens hope to say never more to Tom Brady and the New England Patriots. Pats didn't seem to have a weakness last Saturday against the Broncos, though.
No, they didn't. Brady and his super-duper tight ends, Rob Gronkowski and Aaron Hernandez, they were unstoppable. But, Scott, it will not be target practice like that for Brady against Baltimore. At least it shouldn't. The Ravens guard opponents very well.
They've got a great defense, yeah.
They do. A little long in the tooth, but great. They guard opponents well. They allow the third fewest yards to tight ends in the NFL this season. And if Baltimore linebacker Terrell Suggs can bring the heat on Brady like he's done in the past, it can make things very uncomfortable for New England's golden boy quarterback.
Mm. Second game, of course, is the NFC, and it's the New York Giants versus the San Francisco 49ers. Now, I must say, underestimated the Giants all year, seen them only a couple of times, but the 49ers have made the best comeback since Seabiscuit against Man of War. they've got a relentless defense. How do you see this falling?
This is a really tough call. I would say the Giants probably are the more complete team. They've got a very strong defense, especially their pass rushers. They've got the better quarterback in Eli Manning, but San Francisco's defense is really good. A great tackling team and a very hard-hitting team. The Niners lead the league in knocking out opposing running backs, meaning they hit them and they don't come back into the game. Now, a couple of factors in the 49ers' favor. They have the best field goal kicker in the league this year, left-footed David Akers. He's a very good guy to have in a close game. And also, Scott, the game time forecast is for rain in San Francisco, and that might diminish Eli Manning's passing advantage. Also, a slick football might also play into San Francisco's strength of forcing turnovers. Niners are one of the best in the league at that.
What matchup would you like to see in the Super Bowl, Tom?
I have decided late last night after pondering this, I want to see the 49ers in the Super Bowl. They've had a really special season under first-year head coach Jim Harbaugh.
Yeah.
The Pats versus the 49ers is East Coast versus West Coast. Best offense versus best defense, bring it on.
Yeah, I agree. A quick baseball question. Tonight, the National League Most Valuable Player Banquet, Ryan Braun of the Milwaukee Brewers is expected to be there to pick up his award and maybe see a few words, but that could be awkward, right?
Could be. You know, he tested positive for elevated levels of testosterone back in November, and he faces a 50-game suspension if his appeal fails.
And what do you think he might do? Any indication?
Oh, you know, I think people are thinking maybe he'll say something. I don't think so. He's going to pick up his award and not say much and probably nothing about the drug situation, which is too bad. It would be great if Braun got up on the dais and started a dialogue about performance-enhancing drugs, all about it. If he's innocent, say that. If he's guilty, admit it. You know, we can dream about something like this, but it probably just isn't going to happen.
Ah, you dreamer. Tom Goldman, NPR sports correspondent. Thanks so much.
You bet.
The late 19th century saw scores of celebrated, valorous attempts for men to reach the North Pole. Groups of explorers from the U.S., Europe, and Scandinavia invented clever new equipment. They raised bales of money, stirred national pride, and enthralled the world by attempting to march, sail, or sled to the most cold, remote, and unseen place on Earth. A Swedish man named S.A. Andre decided to try to fly above all that. In 1897, Andre and his crew of two, Nils Strindberg and Knut Frankel, set out for the North Pole in a hydrogen balloon. The story of their journey, S.A. Andre, and that age of Arctic exploration is told in Alec Wilkinson's new book, The Ice Balloon. Mr. Wilkinson, a longtime writer for The New Yorker, joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You come up with an astonishing statistic in the book. At least 1,000 people tried to reach the North Pole before 1930. How many of them died?
751.
So undertaking a mission was statistically, at any rate, a foolish thing to do.
It was certainly to have to summon all the courage one possessed and a great deal of both visionary and pioneer thinking.
S.I. Andre worked in the Swedish patent office. He was desk-bound. So what made him an explorer?
He had this obsessive idea to reach this place by this unconventional means, which would be extraordinarily efficient. I mean, his study of the weather and the winds and so forth persuaded him that he'd be there in fewer than 60 hours. I think it must have been semi-facetious, but sort of joked that he would, you know, having flown over the pole, he would descend in San Francisco. And he had a tuxedo with him so that he could, at the end, meet the dignitaries that he imagined would be waiting for him, although he really believed that he was going to end up somewhere in the Yukon or the Siberian wilderness and would have to walk back to civilization.
What happened when the balloon was launched?
The reason Andre thought that he could make it to the pole was that he had believed he had designed a balloon that could be steered. Hot air balloons and hydrogen balloons, of course, can only go where the wind blows them. But Andre had constructed a special system of heavy ropes that lay on the ground and were dragged that would sort of impede the balloon and cause it to travel slower than the air. And as soon as you're traveling slower than the air, as in a sailboat, for example, you can steer yourself because you can put up a sail. So as he took off, the ropes tangled, became untangled, and he lost them. And so he sailed off over the horizon in a balloon he wasn't able to steer.
Can you tell from this distance of time, should he have turned back as soon as those lines were cut? Should he have said, no, this isn't the way to do it?
One would think so, but it's important to remember the context was this, which is that he had the support of Alfred Nobel, the inventor of dynamite. He had the support of the King of Sweden. He had tried to leave in 1896 but hadn't got favorable winds. He gets back to Spitsbergen in 1897, knowing pretty much that this will more or less be his last chance. Faced with the thought, if I don't go now, I may never go again, and I will never know the mystery. I think it overtook him. His rationality, his engineering mind, succumbed to a certain degree, like a temptation one finally submits to the idea of, I must.
Mr. Wilkinson, how much do we know about what happened after the balloon left the sight of reporters from around the world who'd gathered there on this island off of Spitsbergen?
Well, the strange circumstance is that Andre sailed over the horizon and was lost. He and his companions became the first man ever to be lost in the air. Astonishingly, 33 years later, he was discovered. His last camp was discovered by sealers. With Andre were found diaries that they had kept of what had become a death march across the ice. And furthermore, and even more astonishingly, were found films that had been unexposed, taken along the way on the expedition. So 33 years later, suddenly, as if they had almost come back from the afterlife, these men were vivid again in the world's imaginations.
They didn't reach the pole.
They did not reach the pole, no.
What happened, do we know?
Well, they flew for 3 days. They began, though, they ran into trouble with fog that is always a perilous circumstance for a balloon because any shadow causes the gas to cool. And once the gas cools, the balloon descends. And they were eventually, after 3 days of flight and several hundred miles, brought to the ice. And they were suddenly no longer explorers. They were adventurers. Mm-hmm. And no explorer wants to be an adventurer.
I mean, this turned what had been conceived of as a mission to fly above all that and to soar over the pole into a conventional slog with three people who were ill-equipped.
Pretty much. You had three guys with desk jobs from Stockholm who hadn't done a whole lot of preparation. They really did not expect to come down. Yeah. It was a thuggish and punishing journey that was ahead of them, made much more horrible by the fact that as they advanced, the ice moved in the other direction beneath them because, of course, the ice is drifting. The polar ice pack moves.
In the end, where do you weigh the balance between bravery and foolishness of Andre's mission?
It's a fascinating question, isn't it? If the Wright brothers had crashed and died, would they be madmen? But that's sort of the problem with being a pioneer, is that when you're the very first person to step off into space and off the edge of the Earth, there are perils awaiting you that you can't quite imagine. And The thing about pursuits such as Andre's is that they are the results of obsession. And once any of us steps into the realm of obsession, we have constantly to wonder, are we being right? It's usually determined by the failure or success of the thing that happened to these people. But some people fail very honorably, and certainly Andre's failure was honorable.
Mr. Wilkinson, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Alec Wilkinson, his new book, The Ice Balloon. You can read an excerpt at npr.org.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
We need to do something about online piracy by foreign websites.
Stop SOPA! Pass on HIPAA!
And it's pretty clear to many of us that there's a lack of consensus at this point.
That's House Leader John Boehner and White House Press Secretary Jay Carney on two bills to curb online piracy. Under enormous pressure, Congress abandoned those bills this past week. James Fallows of The Atlantic joins us now, as he does most Saturdays, for a look behind the headlines. Jim, good to have you here.
Thank you, Guy.
Let me start out with a story about what's known as SOPA and PIPA. These were supposed to easily pass in Congress. Basically, a massive campaign mounted by technology companies sunk them. What happened with this thing, Jim?
This was fascinating in several ways. One was the speed of the change that happened. As you noted, a week ago, 10 days ago, almost everybody would have thought this would have gone through the Congress without much problem. But just in a couple of days, because of the boycott mounted by Wikipedia, Google had blacked out logos on its page, you saw just hour by hour senators backing off their support for the bill. And the Obama administration also, which had sort of tacitly approved it, moved away. The additional aspect of this that was so interesting is you could sort of sum it up as a San Francisco versus Hollywood struggle.
Because Hollywood supported it.
Exactly. So you had the content creators saying we need this protection against piracy. And then you had the technology industry of Northern California saying that this is too clumsy and crude a tool, that we understand the need for intellectual property protection, but in so doing, you're going to wreck a lot of the basic infrastructure of the internet. And the idea that in that struggle, the traditional political powers of Hollywood, who had also been very important to the Democratic Party traditionally, they were not able to outwit or outpull the new powers of the internet industry. That was a sign of a kind of a correlation of forces we haven't seen.
I mean, I'm wondering if this was squashed so easily, some of these tech companies, I mean, I wonder if they're going to come to regret this in the future. Google, for example, you've pointed out, they are really worried about their intellectual property. They are fiercely protective over their source code, I guess to the extent that they don't even give it to their Chinese office.
Exactly. So the technology industry understands that intellectual property is important. It just hasn't paid as much attention to movies and music, et cetera. And probably the apparent defeat of this bill will be a step towards a more sensible solution.
But for now, the battle is over.
Yes.
Let me turn to another story that we're going to be hearing a lot about next week, and that is President Obama's State of the Union speech. Normally, these speeches are staid affairs. Doesn't matter which president is delivering them, but this is an election year. Are we likely to see a campaign speech?
We are, and I mean that in a good way. Something that's bad about these speeches, and as you know, Guy once worked on them for President Carter long ago, is that State of the Union speeches are essentially contracts, or they are tender offers. They're manifestos.
Here's what we're going to do.
Exactly. And every branch of the government gets mad if there's not one clause about its program. Every country in the rest of the world gets mad if they're not mentioned, et cetera. But when a president is preparing for a re-election year, there's a different sense to the State of the Union speech. Even though presidents have a disproportionate share of airtime and headspace and all the rest in the American consciousness, for the last couple of months, it's mainly been his Republican challengers who've been on the air with all their debates. And so we haven't heard as much directly from the president as we usually do. And so his case about what the Republicans are saying on the overreach of government, about his medical care plan, about who's responsible for the economy, I think we'll hear a preview of the way he wants these issues to be considered in the next 10 months.
This past week, President Obama took some people by surprise, I guess you could say, by storm when he stood up to sing this. Take a listen, Jim.
So in love.
That is not Al Green, President Obama.
I thought that was incredibly gutsy a thing to do, because to try a cappella in front of a big crowd just to do a riff on the Reverend Al Green.
At the Apollo Theater, by the way.
At the Apollo Theater reminded me of the time during the campaign when he was on some military base in the Middle East, and he attempted this three-point basketball shot.
And he made it.
He made it. It was nothing but net. So this was a big risk, and I am impressed that he pulled it off.
Those guys didn't think I would do it. I told you I was going to do it.
That's James Fallows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can find his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Ty. I'm so